Hi, this is Dr. David Stevens, your host of Christian Doctors Digest. Thanks for joining me. Well, it's just about time to head back to school. Hard to believe the summer's over, and students across the country are heading back to primary school, junior high school, college, and even medical school. That's why this is a special back-to-school edition. First of all, we're going to let you know some exciting news about new Christian medical schools starting in the country. And then we're going to kind of cone down on some of the issues that you'll be seeing in your practice that are coming from campuses across the United States. Well, let's don't take any longer. Let's get back to school. It's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Daryl Lovins to this Christian Doctors Digest microphone. Daryl graduated from Bethel College, did his medical degree at Kirksville College of Osteopathic Medicine, then joined the Navy, where for 26 years he served with great distinction, not only as a medical officer on a number of large ships, but also founding a family medicine residency program at Camp Lejeune. After his retirement, he joined the Pikeville College School of Osteopathic Medicine in 2005, and then in 2008 joined William Carey University as they began their osteopathic school. I wanted Daryl to join us and just give us a little history of the program there and let you understand their mission as we touch bases with some of the deans of these new schools. I think it's going to be exciting and encouraging to you to see what God is doing to raise up more Christian doctors. Daryl, it's great to have you with me here on Christian Doctors Digest, and I just wanted our members to hear the story of William Carey University there and the osteopathic school that you've been part of and some of the mission and vision. Just dive into it for us and tell us what's going on and how this got going.
Well, Dave, how the Christian University here at William Carey got involved in osteopathic medicine really predates Katrina, where we were approached with the idea that Mississippi, being the poorest state in the nation with poorest health statistics, needed more primary care physicians. And that's sort of a benchmark, bellwether, whatever you want to call it, for the osteopathic profession. Most of us stay in family medicine, primary care. Mm-hmm. We have our subspecialty training programs, but we have been primarily a family practice-driven profession. And so William Carey was approached with the idea pre-Katrina. Katrina hits, takes off plans offline for a few years, and in 2006, the plan was resurrected to the thought of bringing a College of Osteopathic Medicine here at William Carey. It has been the vision of the Mississippi Osteopathic Medical Association to really have an osteopathic school here in Mississippi, and it dates back almost 40 years to a gentleman named Henry Pace, who is a PhD pharmacologist who taught at Ole Miss, who basically saw a need for physicians and saw that many qualified students weren't getting into medical school in the traditional MD schools because of MCATs, grades, and cutoffs. And what he said, there are fine people who can do this work and be great physicians. And so he contracted with several osteopathic schools to send Mississippi students and Alabama students, Louisiana students, Arkansas students off to several osteopathic schools to start populating the state with DOs. And he's been doing that for probably close to 40 years. So with that background, Mississippi Osteopathic Medical Association said, where can we partner to put a school? And it fell naturally into William Carey's lap. 2008, Dr. Mike Murphy was hired as the inaugural dean in January to start the process off, and I came and joined the school in July of 2008 as the Associate Dean Clinical Sciences. And from there, we started developing our training network, our hospital networks, our preceptor sites, and recruiting and hiring curriculum. We took our first class in August of 2010. They are just getting ready to hit the streets as far as their clinical rotations. And we use a community-based training model, so it's not your typical university training where a medical student enters into the medical school and then goes through a complexes of the children's hospital, the women's hospital, the VA hospital, and all the mega hospital complexes with an occasional rotation out to community hospitals. We do most of our training in community hospitals. And that's where, from a missionary standpoint, in the sense of how do we populate rural and underserved areas of the Gulf South, particularly places like the Mississippi Delta, well, you recruit from the area.
Mm-hmm.
You train them in the area, and when they finish their residencies, hopefully they will go back to the area. And that's where we are. And if I could show you a map, I've got a visual of a map where we have our 200 students, and it basically, we've color-coded them into red and white push pins on one of our maps, and you just take a look at where they're coming from, and it is all over Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas, Alabama, Northwest Florida. We do have some folks from New Jersey and out of state, but they have ties to Mississippi. So we are unapologetically primary care for rural and underserved Gulf South regions and underserved populations. And we're unabashedly recruiting from our target area.
Sure.
And the reason is it's hard to get people to come into an area that they're saying, oh, this, it's Mississippi. Well, Mississippi, and don't let this get out to anybody, but it's a very well-kept secret. It's a great place to live and work.
Yeah. It's also got some great fishing down there. I've done a little bit of fishing in Mississippi, so a lot of great outdoor sports as well as good family places to live. So.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, people like B.B. King, Morgan Freeman, Gerald McCraney, you know, big-name people. And let's see, a fellow named Jim Henson.
Mm-hmm.
Came from Mississippi, you know, the birth of the blues in Mississippi. Oh, wait a minute, there was this guy named Elvis, too, as I recall.
That's right. I was going to say, he sounds like you're trying to recruit students right now.
but you're right.
What about the mission emphasis? I know with a name like William Carey at the university that there is admiration for that. And do you have students that are planning to go even further out in around the world?
We do. We have some folks coming in specifically looking at, and of course, we accept any student who is qualified to apply. You know, the modern rules of engagement are you cannot discriminate on any way, shape, or form, religion, sex, all mm-hmm. of the usual things
sure.
that come with all of that. But people self-select to come here, and a good portion of our students are students of faith. And so that they come in with a background of already having done missionary work, and in fact, some of our students take some of their time in the summer and go with local church agencies. We have Baptist medical missions here is in our area that sends folks out. And we're actually, as we mature, looking to perhaps do some overseas missions as a formal area of training. Now, that's going to take some international laws, and it's already been done at other osteopathic schools. Virginia and other schools have medical clinics out, not necessarily under a missions label, but they have them there. But for me also, the other part is we have the poorest population in the country.
Mm-hmm.
There is a place called the Mississippi Delta. And for the listeners and folks, it is not the mouth of the Mississippi down in New Orleans. When people think Delta, they think mouths of river. The Mississippi Delta is actually in the northwest corner of Mississippi along the Arkansas border, where there's the confluence of the Yazoo Rivers and the Mississippi. And it is the richest farmland really outside of the San Joaquin Valley in California. And we have a very, very poor population of folks who absolutely love it. And you talk about hunting and fishing and all that, that's the area to go. You don't have to go far. There's a lady named Sister Ann Brooks. Ann is a DO physician and been up in the Mississippi Delta with, I think, two or three of her other sisters out of her order for the last 25 years delivering family practice care in Tutwiler, Mississippi. She needs help.
Mm-hmm.
So from a mission standpoint, yes, we're thinking international, but we also have a very local need immediately within our state. We have 82 counties in Mississippi, all of which are either underserved completely or underserved in some sort of patient population.
What about urban outreach, Daryl? I know there's...
Same thing on the urban outreach. We have, we're just up the road in Laurel, Mississippi. And we've got some clinics down here that we're working with our AHECs and our regional associations, but we also have some missionary outreach clinics that our students will be participating in,
yeah.
and in the urban side. But when you talk urban in Mississippi, you're either talking Jackson, Gulfport, you're taking a look at the Memphis border up there, Tupelo. But in the classic high-end urban areas, we don't have the large cities
mm-hmm.
that most other people have in their states. I mean, heavens,
right.
the Houston has more people in it than five states combined.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But I know some of the efforts in New Orleans and other places, some of the difficult areas. And I just love your view of this, because missions begins at home, and there's needs here, and God's going to move some people maybe further afield, but you're really focused in on what you're trying to do. What makes the university unique, besides what you're trying to train, other factors that you think the osteopathic school there does that may be unique?
Well, we are the first really in the Gulf South region, so that puts us in a unique setting. Mississippi was the last state to fully license DOs, and we don't have enough time on the CD to go into the history of what used to happen. Let's say 70 years ago, you and I wouldn't be having this conversation.
Yeah.
There was animosity between the two degrees in the profession of medicine. And notice I chose my words very precisely, because we are in the profession of medicine. We just have a different degree, mm-hmm. and we have some different philosophical orientations. But what makes us unique is we're bringing traditional osteopathic care, we're teaching manipulation, we're bringing in disaster medicine. This is, however, the place where Katrina came in.
Sure.
And the evacuees came here. We're looking at regional health issues, because we have a very diverse population within the state of Mississippi, in addition to the fact that we are located on a Christian campus, and we've got just excellent support from the people around us. And what I've found is not so much the uniqueness of the osteopathic degree, but the need is so intense here in Mississippi that as I have visited hospitals, the folks up there saying, if you're willing to help put doctors to help us in these rural areas, we really don't care what the letters are at the end of your name, just as long as you're turning out good doctors. And oh, by the way, if they're family practice or other primary care, we would really like that. And that's almost a universal statement out of all the hospitals I have visited throughout the region, whether it's a 25-bed hospital or a 400-bed hospital, the need is great. So we have a uniqueness, and then we also have the richness of William Carey and who he was and the legacy of India, which is very much celebrated on the campus here.
That's great. What do you see in the future? I know you're 2 years into it, and I'm sure those have been challenging years as anything as you started up is, but it sounds like things are moving well. What do you see down the road?
Residencies. Mm-hmm. Right now, we have a crunch for resident positions. I sit with the Council on Postdoctoral Training of the American Osteopathic Association, and we track AOA residencies and ACGME residencies, and we need to figure out strategies to get people to train in rural areas. The Flexner Report 1910 changed how we did medical education in the country. The Balanced Budget Act of 1997 and the withdrawal of subsidies to medical schools in 1980 changed how we do medical education. So financing and education and residencies and postdoctoral training right now is really critical. And we're reaching a point where everybody has seen the crunch on doctors nationwide, and depending on your data of who you believe, 64,000 doctors upwards to 325,000 doctors short by 2025. If we ramp up our training in medical schools, we're not going to have residency positions to put them into. And so where the future is for us is asking folks to go back and look at the Hippocratic Oath and look at their root word of what the word doctor means and education means, and you know, docere and educare, meaning to teach and to care or nurture. And so we need to have folks willing to teach students and willing to teach residents and willing to engage the next generation of doctors, because worst case scenario, guys in my age bracket, I'm a boomer, if we retire, we have created a deficit of doctors that is far worse than we'd even anticipate.
Yeah.
And so residency is number one. Let me back up to something that you mentioned on sort of outreach and missions a little earlier. We train in osteopathic manipulation, meaning our students are actually physically doing physical examinations, and we teach physical examination in the first year of medical school concurrently with the other courses. And that's it's sort of an osteopathic tradition in many schools. Last year, we sent 13 students up to northeast Mississippi to do school physicals with two of our preceptors. And they brought back stories of things like, a mom didn't have money to get her four children's physicals, and she knew that sports was a way to keep them off the streets and out of drugs. And so here we show up with 13 medical students, two preceptors, and we do free sports physicals for this lady, and she's going, you know, how much do I owe you? And I said, nothing. You're kidding. No, we're not. And she just broke down in tears, saying, I couldn't afford that. You know, and now, $100, most of us are going, eh, okay, most of them are like, I can afford a $25 physical. But when you have four kids and you know, $100 is $100. And so that's the type of impact our pediatrics club, from a outreach program, has been working with local folks and won the national award from an osteopathic pediatrics club standpoint, and we're only in our second year.
Wow,
just on their outreach and what they're doing. And so the future is bright. The future is residencies. The future, and as I, and again, don't let this get out to anybody who's a prospective student, is some of our folks come here thinking, oh, it's medical school, it's all about the students. No, it's all about the patient. And we'd start that from day one. Is everything we have to learn, whether people don't come here to study medicine, and I ask them at the beginning of every year, who of you all came here to study medicine? And all the hands go up, and I say, you just failed your first test. And they kind of have this strange look, and they said, you come here to study and learn about people. And along the way, you're going to learn anatomy and physiology and biochemistry and pharmacology and all of that. Because we do this in service to people. Because if you just want to study the science of medicine, there are other ways to do this. But this is an applied art and an applied science that you can never forget where your ultimate, and some people hate the word customer, and I have no problem with it, your ultimate customer is the patient. And you've got to always think of how is this going to relate to the patient I'm going to care for. Because at some point you're going to have to remember the information we're giving you in order to better care for it. So learn to study people, look at people. When you're walking in Walmart, take a look at how people walk, how they dress, how they're, you know, observe and learn all you can about people.
That really emphasizes, Daryl, the covenant relationship that you have as a physician, which unfortunately people are getting away from that. You know, it's just a business, and realizing people are why you do what you do, and they're the end product of what you accomplish, and focus on them. I think that's brilliant what you're doing.
Well, thank you. It's just who I am. I learned a long time ago that, you know, it's a cliche, but people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care.
Right.
And when I was in training in my fellowship in faculty development, I had the opportunity to teach interns with a social worker who had never done teaching. And I said, well, she asked me before we got our first class in of interns for that year, I said, how is it going to go? And I said, well, you're going to see in July some very bright-eyed, bushy-tailed folks who are just eager. And I said, along about Thanksgiving, they're going to hate their patients. And along about February, their eyes are going to open up and they're going to start loving life again.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, why would you use the term hate their patients? And I said, well, it's really, very simple. In training, there are things that physicians want to have. They want to have a good education, but along about November, they want a good night's sleep. And any body who wakes them up in the middle of the night, they see you can eat at any time, you can do other things at any time, but you can only sleep during certain periods. And anybody who steals from you your precious sleep, and this predates the 80-hour work rule, is someone who becomes your enemy. And she didn't believe me, and along about November shows up, and sure enough, they all came in going, I can't believe, you know, the patient woke me up. And every physician, truth be told, we've probably all had those experiences. But ultimately, what differentiates us is we go back to the understanding that it's not about my sleep. It's about what I am here to do to help the other person.
Mm-hmm.
And once they figure that out, and it takes until about February, they make the transition. And it opened her eyes up. And that's something that I want to start opening their eyes a little earlier. Now we have the sleep deprivation and protections and all of the things that we're going in with residency now. But I want to start them early with the idea that you must take care of yourself. And we as physicians live terribly unhealthy lifestyles because of the nature of our work and the covenant relationship, because we're always willing to push ourselves further. But there comes a point, and for me personally, when I started medical school, I was on a Navy scholarship back in 79. I entered medical school with two goals. One was to remain married to the same lady I started medical school with, and that was my number one priority. And the second was to graduate medical school. I graduated in 83, and this year is our 37th anniversary.
Hmm.
And you got to put your priorities in place, because if I would like to think I'm the same person, whether I am a physician, a plumber, or an electrical engineer, my identity of me was me long before I was a physician.
Right.
And that's and I also ask from the future, I ask that the students come to me educated, because I'm going to turn them into physicians. Not to say that we're not educated, but I want them to have arts backgrounds, mathematics background. I'd like to see them play a musical instrument. I want them to have a life outside of medicine that is their place of solitude, their place where they can go and seek refuge and sort of restore their soul. And a wise old person that I read a lot said, "Be still and know that I am God."
Mm-hmm.
We all need to go to a place to be still. Because if we don't do that, we are no good to our patients, our families, our coworkers.
You know, Daryl, I think one of the things you're doing, and it's so clear as you talk, is teaching the philosophy and philosophical foundation of medicine, which is so often missing. And there's no construct for the building, the foundation of the building that we're trying to build in these students' lives and residents' lives. And you just hit the nail on the head in so many ways. We could sit here and talk about this for a long time, but I just want to thank you for what you're doing and for the exciting news from coming out of William Carey. And I think that one of the great joys is going to be seeing some of those students that you're teaching now out in practice and touching their communities and changing lives and ministering to people all over Mississippi and probably some of them clear way around the world. So thanks for what you're doing and for your commitment, and may the Lord bless you.
Thank you, David, and you as well. I've been with CMDA, I can't remember for how long, but I it's just one of those organizations that I see just a very positive benefit to, and in a time where we are walking away from hardcore values, it's nice to see, you know, pillars set in a solid foundation.
Oh, thank you. If you know a student heading back to college and pre-med, nursing, or whatever, I encourage you to get a copy of How to Stay a Christian in College by Jay Bujaszewski. A wonderful book, really set the standard in helping students to cope in a very secular world. Also, we have a great little book for those that you know are in pre-med or pre-dentistry and preparing for a career in medicine. It was written a few years ago, but is a real classic, just a small book, fast read, but really gives a lot of practical information on preparing to get into medical school or dental school, and a lot of good habits to develop that will help you be successful. Both of those are available at our cmda.org, or give us a call at 888-230-2637. It's interesting to know that there's been a 50% increase in the number of osteopathic medical schools in the country over the last decade and a half. Part of the reason for that is because 50% of their graduates are going into primary care versus about 10% of those in allopathic schools. So there's a great encouragement to get more primary care doctors out there, and the government's very much encouraging these schools to start. Also, they're a lot cheaper. It costs about $50 million to start an osteopathic school, close to $100 million to start an allopathic school. So that's why you're seeing these osteopathic schools springing up at Christian schools across the country. Well, let's meet Dr. John Kaufman. He's the founding dean of Campbell University's School of Osteopathic Medicine. John's been an educator for 17 years, obtained his medical degree from the Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine, completed a residency in internal medicine at Lehigh Valley Hospital in Allentown, Pennsylvania. From 2001 to 2006, he worked for University Hospitals of Cleveland, established their osteopathic residencies in dermatology and pediatrics. In 2006, he joined Edward Via College of Osteopathic Medicine in Virginia, where he was the Associate Dean of Postgraduate Affairs and then was promoted to Vice Dean. He's now in North Carolina getting this school up and running. He's moved there with his wife, Sharon, and their four daughters. Let's hear the thrilling story of how God is working in this situation to bring this school to fruition. John, it's great to have an opportunity to chat about what's happening at Campbell University and you guys starting a school there. It's just thrilling to think about what God is doing to get a medical school there on the campus. Tell us how it all started.
It all started back in 2010 when our president was on a SACS accreditation visit to a Baptist college down in Mississippi who he learned was starting a DO medical school. And up until that time, he had not really heard of osteopathic medicine, and our model of starting a medical school and using community hospitals. So he came back with the vision that Campbell University could certainly do this. And they did their due diligence, visiting several other schools, a lot of prayer. And with the go-ahead of the Board of Trustees, move forward to doing a dean search. I came on board in January of 2011 and started the feasibility process and have taken us through the accreditation steps. And right now we have our provisional accreditation, which allows us to begin recruiting students. And the building is, I'm told, 45% complete. We're at about 96,500 square feet, and we're under roof and expect to move into the building by next May.
Wow, that's exciting. I know you guys must be thrilled to see it happen. Tell us a little bit about Campbell University. Some people listening may never even heard of the school. Tell us about the school.
Very well known in North Carolina. We have a law school that leads the state in bar passage rate and a pharmacy school that leads the state in board passage rate. We also have a business school, a divinity school, a school of education. The university itself is 125 years old, and in that time have only had four presidents.
Wow.
And as of 2003 had only had three presidents. So if you want to live to a ripe old age, become the president of Campbell University.
That's pretty good. How big is the student body on the university campus?
The undergraduate student body is around 4,000, and it jumps up to about 8,000 with professional schools, and we do have some branch campuses as well.
That's great. How big is the medical school going to be? How many students are going to be in each class?
We're planning for a class of 150, so we'll have 600 students total after 4 years, and that will make us the second largest school in North Carolina.
How are you going to make this distinctively Christian? I mean, I know you've probably put a lot of thought into that, and talk about your goals and vision for this school compared to, you know, other secular medical schools in this country.
Well, a couple things. The Lord gave me a vision some years back involving training missionary doctors. I remember looking at MedSense homepage some years back and them talking about mission hospitals being unable to keep the doors open due to the lack of missionary doctors.
Mm-hmm.
And also thought, I had spent some time with SIM in Liberia, West Africa, at Elwa.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that struck me there was, to a person, all the docs said that nothing in medical school or residency prepared them for the job that they were called to do there. And the other interesting thing is there had been a surgeon there, but he had moved on. And before doing so, he trained all the family docs to be able to do the surgeries they would encounter. And so what I saw at Elwa was a hospital completely run by family physicians and run very well. And that planted a seed that could we create that same prototypical physician. And so, you know, had tried that at other schools, but again, not being faith-based schools, you know, ran into barriers. And so the opportunity here to be at a faith-based school and train missionary doctors was very attractive. And the other epiphany, though, is these physicians, you know, their mission field may be Africa, but it also may be rural North Carolina or Appalachia.
Sure.
Or inner city Durham. And so that is, you know, one thing that kind of surrounds the vision and surrounds the curriculum. And part of that is driven by, we have medical students in this country who graduate and they've never delivered a baby.
Mm-hmm.
And I look back to medical schools in the 50s and the 60s, and students were given a lot more responsibility. And so when they graduated, they had more clinical competencies than I think some of our students have today. And so part of the vision is to partner with hospitals, mission hospitals in Africa, and really create academic medical centers where U.S. and national students train together and U.S. and national residents train together so that we can form a true partnership where we're helping assist emerging academic centers and also providing training for our students and residents that they might not get here.
Yeah, I love that vision. And as you know from your experience, and I know from mine, missionary medicine is a lot different than what you normally do in this country, even the philosophy of medicine and how you approach it when you have things often that are beyond your skills and abilities, and yet doing that the right way, not becoming a cowboy, but not shying from the challenges of... and then all the other things besides medicine. I mean, it's... a lot more to medicine overseas than just being a good doctor in leadership and management and program development and all the rest. So I'm just thrilled that this university is going to be focusing on that. And besides that, John, there's just this huge renaissance and interest in medical missions. I think we are now mentoring over 1,300 students and residents that are planning to go into career missions and saying, help us get there. And God's just moving in people's hearts. So if there was ever a time for Campbell University and their vision, I think it's right now. God's got something in store. So how did you end up there? I mean, you were over on the mission field, obviously practiced here. You got into academics. What's your story briefly?
Well, I guess it goes back probably 10 years. I was a director of medical education at University Hospitals in Cleveland, part of the case medical school system, and helping them develop DO training programs inside their allopathic residency programs. And I really felt called to come to a medical school. You know, my dream job, if you will, was to be doing medical missions and teaching students and residents and developing residency programs. So I had the opportunity to get down and work at VCOM in Virginia, mm-hmm. who has a terrific international program. And I just learned so much there about international medicine and just about the inner workings in the medical school environment. And it was actually the dean who had come to me and said that Campbell was a Christian school looking to start a medical school. So I went and I met with them, and a couple weeks later they offered me the position under the condition that I could be there in 2 weeks and get the 6-month feasibility study completed in 2 months. And, when this opportunity comes along, I mean, what are you going to say? I said, sure.
Yeah, yeah. And they got on your knees.
Absolutely. And every step of the way. And, you know, that's the other piece that, you know, so many things we've seen to be providential. The president of the university is an academic, PhD sociologist, but also was a Baptist pastor. And we just see the Lord's hand in so many things that happen. At the same time that the medical school is being built independently, a hospital is being built a mile away. And a brand new 30,000 square foot federally qualified health center is being built right across the street from that. We're getting calls from hospitals all over the world, in the Congo and Nigeria, and, you know, talking with SIM folks who would like to partner with us as we create these teaching hospitals, people like Dan Fountain, coming to partner with us, and Bruce Steffes from the Pan-African Council of Surgeons. So I totally agree with you that just the way the Holy Spirit is moving in this direction, it's just been thrilling to see it all unfold.
How can our listeners, doctors, students, and others that are listening, I know they need to pray for you. This is an enormous challenge. But what are the needs there? How can they get the word out about opportunities for those considering going to medical school? Where are you and looking for professors? Are there needs there? There may be academics listening. What are your needs?
Well, you know, first and foremost, prayer, absolutely. You know, we want to do this right. You get one shot, And, you know, as we build the curriculum, as we strive for academic excellence, we really want to bring the best people we can find here. And so, yeah, we have needs. All of our clinical faculty, biomedical faculty, we have several positions open. And, you know, please, I mean, can I put my phone number out
there?
Sure,
I'd be happy for you too.
If folks want to give us a call, I mean, 910-893-1776. Or if they want to send me an email, it would be Kaufman, K-A-U-F-F-M-A-N-J, at campbell.edu. But we've hired our associate deans. We're hiring our chairs. We've just hired a wonderful woman who's been a career academic, strong believer, leads mission trips to Africa every year. But we have other needs, chair of surgery. We need a clinical pathologist, biochemist, you know, physiologist, microbiologist, right on down the line, medical school faculty. And I think one of the strengths here as well is, you know, we very much are open to people who want to come and be a part of this vision. And we're really trying to create a safe environment, you know, where people don't get in trouble for their religious views and beliefs, and, you know, being able to express that.
Yeah, and the whole discipleship part of what you're trying to accomplish, and CMDA wants to be part of that there on campus and help with the students seeing that vision for what God wants to do with their lives.
You know, we think that's extremely important, getting our students early out to the CMDA meetings, especially the mission meeting in November. You know, what a powerful opportunity that is to just network. I've met so many good people there who are just doing great work all over the world, and we see those sorts of opportunities as really foundational to expose our students too early on.
John, I want to thank you for your commitment and your service to all of us and to the cause of the gospel. And I'm sure I'm going to be praying for you, and I know others will be as well. And it's going to be exciting to see what God does as this opens up. We're going to get back together one of these days pretty soon and hear that story as well, and praise the Lord for what He's done. We've already seen His hand, and I think even greater days are ahead. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. This is just such a privilege and an honor to be able to chat with you, and please come down and visit us.
Well, I do encourage you to pray not only for the school there at Campbell, but also for our campus ministry across the country. CMDA is now on 242 campuses, and the number is growing as these new schools start. We're already are getting groups beginning on these campuses. In fact, it was exciting to see some students that will be starting at Campbell University this fall actually come to the national meeting in Ridgecrest a few months ago, and see them already being absorbed into the Christian network of physicians and dentists across the country. I want to encourage you to get personally involved. If you're anywhere near a medical school, or even if you're not, look for opportunities to influence students. Maybe they can come do rotations in your office. Maybe you can just go to the CMDA meeting on campus a couple times. Just break out of your practice for a few minutes. Get over there and visit, meet a few students, invite them to your home, take them out for a cup of coffee. When I talk to students, what they want more than anything else is some time with a real Christian doctor, somebody in practice, so they can see you and meet you and know you and move forward with you as a model as they go into their years, long years of training. It's so helpful to have somebody that's taken an interest in their life. It doesn't take a lot of time, and you'll be so glad that you did it. Exciting things happening through our campus community ministries. The new residency council is up of residents across the United States that are deepening and expanding our ministry to residents. The student council is also making a huge difference. It's so exciting and thrilling for me to hear the stories of how lives are being transformed. People are growing deeper in their faith, and how CMDA has become such an important part of individual students' lives as they go through these challenging days of education. I want to give you an update on something you may not be aware of if you're not in family practice. At the American Academy of Family Practice, just this past fall, a resolution introduced by students and residents passed endorsing same-sex marriage. Many of our members were very upset about this that belonged to the Academy and asked CMDA to take the lead in fighting this. We first surveyed our members to collect data. We then contacted the board of the American Academy of Family Practice. I personally met with the president-elect of the AFP and expressed our concerns, doing this in a civil and caring manner, but and one of great sadness, knowing the negative impact this was going to have on their membership, because many of our members are planning to resign unless this is reversed. After contacting them, we actually wrote a resolution, which we are now submitting to state academies across the country. Oklahoma and some others have already passed this resolution, and the resolution asking the AFP to take a neutral position on this issue will be going to the Academy this August. Can you do something for me? Can you pray that God will work in that meeting, that He will move in the hearts of the delegates out there, and that this very damaging position will be reversed? As happens in other professions, they use this as leverage to change social policy at the state level and at the federal level in their attempts to legalize same-sex marriage. We need to defend marriage, and we need to be voices of righteousness into our culture. We've taken this step with sadness and in concern, and I think we have been able to project that well to the people that we're dealing with. But I think it could have very significant negative effects on the future of family medicine in this country. And if we ever needed a strong academy with all the changes that are happening in healthcare, we need it now. But as you and I pray, God can work. Let's see what He's going to do. Let me introduce to you Dr. Ronnie Martin. Ronnie's got a long and distinguished career in medicine, actually started as a pharmacist in Oklahoma, but after 2 years of practicing that discipline, he went to the Oklahoma College of Osteopathic Medicine and Surgery, graduated from there, completed his residency in family practice, and became board certified. He was in a family practice in Oklahoma for 17 years before moving more fully into academic medicine. He became the chairman of the Department of Family Medicine at Nova Southeastern University College of Osteopathic Medicine in 2001. He was promoted to Associate Dean for Academic Affairs and then moved on to Colorado, where he was the founding dean of Rocky Vista University College, and then on to Virginia, working at the Edward Villa College of Osteopathic Medicine. Just in April of 2012, he became the founding dean of the proposed Liberty University College of Osteopathic Medicine, which is scheduled to open in the fall of 2014. Let's hear more from Ronnie so we know better how to pray and support him as he undertakes this challenging task. Ronnie, starting a medical school at Liberty University, I'm excited. Tell me how all this began and your involvement in it.
Well, it began approximately a year ago with actually longer than that, to be truthful, in that Dr. Falwell had made the statement several years ago that as soon as he could, he wanted to start a medical school to go along with his striving to develop Crusaders for Christ and for his outreach activity. After his demise, his son, Jerry Jr., has carried on that vision and continued to move forward with this aspect. About a year ago, they got very serious about beginning the medical school, went through the process of looking around at what the reality of doing it is rather than just the prospect. I was contacted just before Christmas holidays and asked if I'd be interested interested and have proceeded forward and actually signed a contract in February and showed up here the 1st of April. So it's very exciting. This is a very alive and vivacious campus that's just in the midst. We're a very small segment of a massive growth and development on this campus, and we feel very privileged to be a part of this institution.
What's the vision for the school? What do you hope you're going to produce among medical students? What's going to set Liberty apart, you know, as we look across the country in the landscape of medicine?
For many, many years, for centuries, doctors were keepers of knowledge. Mm-hmm. And they had knowledge that nobody else had, so they demanded respect rather than have to earn it. We really hope to develop healers of men. You know, the greatest physician that ever walked the face of the earth was Jesus Christ, and Jesus Christ did not rely upon his knowledge. He did so much more to heal man, and that means that you have to deal with body, mind, and spirit, and that's the concentration we're going to go. We're hoping to educate osteopathic physicians who historically have a holistic and patient-centered mindset to begin with, and couple that with a very strong Christian environment with that servant's heart attitude that will go out and distinguish these individuals. We hope to send individuals out that will mimic that servant's attitude that Christ demonstrated on earth. And as a result of that, mankind will benefit from them having been out there.
Yeah, and what we're seeing is our challenges in modern-day medicine. I think there's such a wonderful opportunity for Christian doctors to even stand out more with their patient care, their views on ethical issues. I'm excited about what you guys are doing. What's your time frame? When do you think the doors will open, and what has to happen between now and then?
Well, very ambitiously, we hope to take the first students in August of 2014 if we can meet all the accreditation standards. That's very aggressive. It is theoretically possible by the accreditation standards to do in 24 months. They, however, recommend 36 months as more practical. We're going to try very hard to make it within 24 months and start at that point in time. We have some advancement on our building. We have been given support by the Tobacco Commission in Southern Virginia that's provided us some support, and it is our intent to open in August of 2014 with our first class.
How big will the classes be?
We plan on starting with 150 students in our first class, and if the good Lord smiles upon us appropriately, 10 years after that, we'll be up to about 200 students in a class.
What do you need as far as faculty? I know that's one of the challenges as you move forward, and there may be some doctors and have background in academic medicine that may have an interest. What are you looking for?
A little bit of everything. We're mainly looking for the quality of the individual.
Mm-hmm.
Although we hope to hire at full staff, we will have about 20 PhD-level individuals on campus and about 20 full-time clinical physicians on campus, MD-DO, for our full-time faculty. But as your responsibility in a medical school, as you well know, is to graduate well-rounded generalists who are prepared to go into any residency. That's our goal. But we want to influence them to go into the residencies that are greatly needed by underserved and underrepresented individuals, be it primary care or be it general surgery or obstetrics or pediatrics or emergency medicine. So we're going to our initial faculty, our full-time faculty, will be family physicians, pediatricians, obstetricians, and gynecologists, internal medicine specialists. Those are the ones that are the most important for developing the clinical skills and the basic foundational knowledge that we need students to have. You don't make an orthopedic surgeon or a neurological surgeon while they're in medical school. You graduate a well-rounded generalist, and they become that disciplinary specialist during their residency, as you well know.
Yeah. Where are the students going to be doing their clinical rotations? I know it's always something you have to deal with. Will they be there in town, or are they going to have to go further out?
Well, we hope to have the bulk of them here in town. We've have meetings established with the Centra Healthcare System to talk with them about that. They have had the administration here at the school, the chancellor and the vice chancellor, have had some preliminary meetings. We've also had some discussions with hospitals in the immediate area of Southeast Virginia here, but we are not opposed to looking at developing clinical sites at good locations nationwide. nationwide. We realized that more than half of the enrollment here at the university are from all over the United States.
Sure.
And if we're going to recruit that type of individual nationwide, we're going to look, we're going to raise our eyes a little bit further. Someday in our future, once we reach all of the established goals, we will look internationally in underserved areas as a component of our missionary outreach component of the school.
Sure. You beat me to my next question, because I know you're all's passion for medical missions and reaching the world for Christ, and I know there'll be many students that will have an interest in that. How can the Christian doctors in this country help as you move forward? What I guess pray is the most important thing at this point.
Without a doubt, prayer and support is more valuable than anything that we could offer, but we are very interested in any Christian individual that would have an interest in being a part of this mission and vision as a faculty member, as a preceptor. We are starting to recruit right now for full-time and part-time faculty, but we will also need clinical preceptors in a wide variety of areas. And as I said, we're looking for quality individuals. You know, the silent curriculum is so terribly important. What you teach in the classroom is one thing. What you role model and mentor really has more influence, mm-hmm. the same as it does with our children. You know, as we all know, it's not what we say, it's what we do with our children. And so having quality role models, preceptors, and mentors for these individuals is very important to us. And one of the things that we're searching for, and I don't think you can have too many.
Yeah, I agree.
We're not only looking for faculty, but another thing that we're looking for is for clinics and private practices, as well as hospitals and other institutions that would be willing to work with us in the development of curriculum and provision of education to these young men and women.
Ronnie, if people want to get in touch with you, get more information, how can they do that?
They can reach me through Liberty University here, or they can always reach me by email. That's rbmartin4@liberty.edu, or I'm glad to give anybody my cell phone number. That's 720-891-9708. And I would be glad to provide information to discuss the mission and vision to school or discuss opportunities with anybody that choose to contact us.
Great. Ronnie, thanks so much. You've got a big challenge ahead. God's put you in a wonderful place of leadership, and I want to challenge everyone listening to pray as we go forward. God's moving to start Christian medical schools across this country, and Liberty's right there in the forefront of that, and we're just excited about what you're doing. God bless.
Well, we're excited about it, and we're excited for the opportunity, and hopefully with God's guidance and with support and prayer of a lot of people out there, we'll bring this to a very successful ending.
There's another Christian university or two already planning medical schools in the years ahead, so it's exciting to see what God is doing, sweeping across the country, really giving us places where we can even more intensely combine faith with the practice of medicine. You know, there's resources not only for students, medical students, but also we've got some great ministries and resources for wives of medical students and residents. One's a new book called Prescriptions for the Doctor's Wife, Hope and Help for Your Unique Marriage. It's written by Debbie Reed, and it's an excellent book. I highly, highly recommend it. What a great gift to give to someone who is going into that difficult time of training. It gives some great practical advice on how to keep your marriage strong and really be together in ministry. Along with that, of course, is our side-by-side ministry. It's now on 42 campuses across the United States, really taking the biblical mandate of older women coming alongside younger women to mentor and disciple them. And it's just a wonderful program. Check it out on cmda.org. Find out if one is in your area where you can be involved as a mentor, where you can refer students, or if you are a student or resident, where your spouse can get involved. Also, a date to mark on your calendar, October the 12th. If there's any way you can get to Wilmore, Kentucky, I can tell you how to get there. That's the town I was raised in. At Asbury University, we're going to have a filming of the video series for Grace Prescriptions, and where you need a live audience there. You'll love getting on this campus. They have a new state-of-the-art, very unique communications and media center. This is going to be shot live in front of the audience. And not only will you get the joy of really getting a real boost in how to share your faith in your practice, do spiritual histories with Walt Larimore and Bill Peel. But you'll also get to be on camera and be part of this ministry that's literally going to go in this country and around the world, training healthcare professionals how to do spiritual ministry in their practices. If you'd like to get more information, just go to cmda.org. You'll find information on how you can register. I'll be there. Hope to see you there as well. It's a pleasure to have Joe McElhaney join me here at the microphone. Joe lives in Plano and been very involved in CMDA for many, many years. He's an OBGYN. He was in private practice for 28 years. In 1992, he started the Medical Institute for Sexual Health, a nonprofit scientific educational research organization, really trying to educate about the crisis of sexually transmitted diseases, promiscuity, what that was doing in our culture in schools, and also setting policy in the government. He's been very active in Washington and the CDC. In 2001, he was appointed to the Presidential Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS, and he's also served on the advisory committee to the director of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. He's a faithful witness, a real prophet in our time, and his books have touched so many people. His first one, 1001 Healthcare Questions Women Ask, his book Hooked, and the most recent one, which we're going to learn about today, Girls Uncovered. Joe, it's always great to have you on, and I have such great admiration for what you've done through the Medical Institute. Let's talk about Girls Uncovered, your latest book.
Truth is, I wanted to name the book Naked Girls, but they said the publisher said, well, no, it'd show up on pornographic sites, and we couldn't do that.
Yeah.
So we compromised with Girls Uncovered, and the reason we named it that was because of the thesis of the book, and that is that societies have always protected the sexuality of their young women. And did it for obvious reasons. A tribe that didn't protect its young women's sexuality would die out if the girls didn't get pregnant, if they had problems. And that's been a characteristic of societies always in the past. Sometimes they did it in ways that to us don't seem very nice, but they did it until Western society came along. And our society today basically provides no direction for young women, no protection, no guidance. It leaves them open to the desires of guys, but also even to their own inborn, I think, God-given desires about sexuality and sexual behavior.
You know, the book is just full of great information, and then you back it up with study after study after study, but let's dig into it a little bit. I mean, our kids are just sexually assaulted with sex. I mean, from a very young age, and you make that so clear in what you write, and the statistics are just grim.
Well, you're exactly right, David. And so that's one of the theses, one of the parts of the thesis that we like to emphasize, and that is that kids are being assaulted by influences out there that are going to have an impact on them. And the issue for our young people is that their brains are not totally mature until about the mid-20s. A guy named Jay Geed at Bethesda at the NIH with his functional MRI study showed that kids' brains just aren't totally mature until the mid-20s. And the part that matures last is the prefrontal cortex. It has to do with judgment, decision-making, morality, and so forth. And so it's those things that we need to give guidance to. And they're going to get guidance one way or another, David. Like you said, it's either going to be from today's media, which is just often very bad for the kids, or it's going to be from parents. And our real emphasis in this book is that parents need to realize that they really do have they can have a major impact on the behavior choices of the young people and of their morality as they grow up and of their faith. Which is a core issue for young people.
I think that's absolutely true, and yet it's an uphill climb. I mean, it's harder than it's ever been. Somebody said to something about, you know, our three kids all being involved in ministry and, you know, kind of inferring we've been wonderful parents. I said, listen, I raised my kids overseas. It was a lot easier than what you had to do. You know, people said, how can you go to that jungle in Africa? Well, no, the jungle's here. This is the most dangerous place to raise your kids. I could let my child out 10 miles from the hospital. Somebody brought him home. Nobody had hurt him. I didn't have to worry somebody give him drugs. I didn't have to worry about what they were being taught at school because we were homeschooling. it's challenging here to raise godly children, and you need information and a plan and good advice, and that's what this book is full of, not only for those listening for their own children or grandchildren, but also to put into the hands of their patients to give them the protection. This is some of the best preventive medicine they can get to not have their hearts broken and the hearts broken of their daughters.
I could not agree with you more, David. You know, one of the things that we point out at the very start of this book is how high young women's aspirations are. And I think it would actually surprise even us as physicians that the aspirations of young women are incredible. About one in four of them say they want a job that requires a doctoral degree.
Hmm.
And then that's a fourth of them. Another 40% say they want to have a professional career such as nursing or engineering, something that doesn't require a doctoral level degree. So kids really, especially young women, that's what this book is about. This book is about young women. But 95% of girls say it's quite important or extremely important for them to be successful in their chosen field. So young women in the high school age level really want to be successful in that. And the other thing is that they want to have a marriage. 90% of them say they want to have a marriage and a family life and that it's really important to them. Only 5% say that they don't want to be married at all. They want a good career, and they want a good marriage. And they also want children, and almost all of them, essentially 95% of them, say they do plan to have children when they do get married. But the question then is, if these high aspirations are there, what's happening? And I think that's what we're trying to emphasize here, that because of the bad influence of society, just like you're talking about, David, we see this phenomenal dropout rate of young women in what happens to them. You know, about 6% of girls drop out of high school, and usually they talk about personal things like getting pregnant, causing that. And then of the ones that finish high school, about 50% of those even enroll in college, much less finish. And usually they talk about it being personal things that have happened to them, and much of that often is either depression or pregnancy. So they have high aspirations. They're not achieving those aspirations, much of it because of the horrible guidance they're getting from society. And we as parents and we as Christian leaders and people wanting to give guidance and physicians can have such an incredible impact on giving good guidance to these young people.
Kind of summarize the messages. I mean, I know people know them, but you so well articulate them in the book and then back it up with great data, giving great ammunition as we talk to patients and talk to families that we know about these issues. Why don't you summarize some of those?
The very first thing to say about it, David, is this. And boy, you know, it's just something that we at the Medical Institute like to emphasize again and again. That is that parents do have a much greater impact on the young people than they think they do. When a mother or dad is sitting there talking to their 14 or 15-year-old kid, and he's giving them that dumb look like, I've heard this before, I don't want to hear it again, please stop talking, he's hearing. Essentially, all the data we've seen, we've been looking at this for years, says that more kids will say that their parents influence their behavior choice than their peers or than any other influence, in spite of what we keep hearing about the media and about peers. Still, more kids will say their parents influence them than anything else. That is an incredible thing. But we can't this is the second part of that, and that is that we can't just say it one time. It requires a continual message as they get older, a message that is more age-appropriate for them about not just sex, but about what's appropriate to do in every area of life. Because remember, those brains are molding and taking this in, and the brains actually physically mold. The axons and dendrites form or die in relationship to what the kid is being told and taught and doing. So that's the first message. The second is that we'll sometimes hear that kids in Christian environments or kids that are Christians are not doing any better than the secular kids. Well, if you look at kids to whom their faith is not important, that may be true. But if you look at young people whose faith is important, who pray, go to church regularly, and who themselves say it's important, the studies clearly show again and again that their faith actually helps them avoid sexual involvement, helps them be less likely to be on drugs, less likely to be depressed or to attempt suicide. I might read one little quote we have, David, if
sure.
we have time.
Yeah.
This is from Laura Sessions Stepp, who has a great understanding of young people. In her book, Unhooked, How Young Women Pursue Sex, Delay Love, and Lose It Both, she says, this leaves one about faith. This leaves one wondering whether after all the ambitious child-rearing that parents of this generation of students have done, all the discovery toys, Suzuki piano lessons, 4 a.m. swim practices, SAT practice classes, and summer camps at faraway places, they might have done as well or better and saved a lot of money just by taking their kids to church, temple, or mosque.
Hmm.
So she's saying, look, when you look at the data, it's clear that faith is vital to young people making good decisions. So I think it's fair for us as physicians, even in our offices, as we're talking to a parent or to a young person, to encourage that in their lives.
You have a great chapter, when I was reading the book, it was just great stuff. And then all of a sudden there's a chapter, What Are Girls to Do, really directed towards our daughters. It's a short chapter, but powerful. And I thought that was it was great because you kind of summarize what you've been saying and speak directly to the teenager or young adult about these issues, and then, of course, bring it all together. It's a great book, Joe. I hope people will read it. It'll equip them to inform others and then give us a gift. I can't think of something that would be better to put in someone's hands. You've done a great work.
Well, thank you. You and I love young women. You know, I've committed my life to them, and I know you have too. And we just want the best for them. They have high aspirations. They're worth it, and thank you for getting this message out for parents particularly.
God bless.
Thank you for this time. Bless you too.
Well, now you know what to get someone as a gift, or maybe for your own family. Girls Uncovered, it's available at our toll-free line, 888-230-2637, or at cmda.org. Just go to the bookstore, and you'll find a copy of it there. As Josh McDowell said, doctors, counselors, pastors, and parents all ought to read this book in order to gain better understanding of the challenges young women face today in the fight for true physical and emotional health that leads to a bright future. Well said. Last time we got together on Christian Doctors Digest, I mentioned our new program of regular giving, just signing up to be faithful without having to think about it, having to write a check, just saying, I'd like to commit this much to help CMDA in its ministry each year and take that out of my credit card or my checking account on a monthly, quarterly, or annual basis, whatever works for you. I want to encourage you to do that. I'm tired of sending appeal letters. You're tired of getting them. It costs a ton of money to send those and put them in your mailbox. And I know, like they do at my house, most of those type of appeal letters end up in the trash can. So won't you pray about it? Talk to your spouse about it if you're married. Decide what God's asking you to do and become a regular supporter of CMDA above and beyond your dues. That's what's going to help us make us even more effective in ministry. You know, as we close this Christian Doctor's Digest, I can't help but think back many years ago when I was a missionary and going into churches, and our children were very young, and of course we were missionaries in Africa, in a bush area of the country. And every once in a while somebody would walk up to me and say something in a variation of, how can you take your kids over there to that jungle? Isn't it dangerous? What about education? What about this, that, and the other? And people just kind of appalled that, in many ways, that we would take our kids overseas. And one time I just kind of, without thinking, turned back to one of them and said, you know, we don't really live in the jungle, which we didn't, but you all do. Probably the most dangerous place to raise your children between these two places is where you are in this jungle in the United States. Our kids just get impacted in so many ways through the media, through their friends, through what's happening in our culture, through our schools. It's a challenge to raise your kids. And I know, like you do, so many wonderful Christian parents that have had significant problems with their own kids. And often it's because of the competition for attention and the values that our culture is teaching them. It's so hard to protect them. Where I was on the mission field, we didn't have to worry about TV, didn't have to worry about radio, didn't worry about what's going to happen at the mall. Somebody's going to kidnap them at the mall. I went home every night and spent the evening with my kids. My kids came up to the hospital to see what I was doing. What a wonderful place to raise kids. And I go back and thank God for those early years that we had our job a lot easier than many of you do. But you know, as we've talked today about medical schools, about this latest book on Girls Uncovered, it just reminds me that the basis and bottom line of what we need to be doing is praying. Secondly, we need to be planning. It's not going to go well just because we pray and then don't put works to our faith. It's going to have to be prospective, intentional efforts to mold and model our kids, to protect them from the evils of our culture, to prepare them to live in a highly secular world, to resist the temptations that their friends and the culture brings to them every day. It's difficult, and I think more than ever, we as parents need to be down on our knees praying for our kids and then up working hard to do everything we can to help them to grow up to be the godly children and godly teenagers and the godly adults that we know God wants them to be. Perhaps I'm thinking more about these days as we now have our grandchildren and we look at our influence on their lives during these very formative years. I want to be faithful. I know you too as well. Lots of great resources here at CMDA to help you do that. And if you can't find them here, check out your local Christian bookstore. But let's work together to raise up a generation, not just of Christian doctors, but a generation of Christian children. They're going to affect their world no matter what God calls them to do. I want you to know that we're here cheering you on. We're praying for you. We're trusting the Lord that God is going to use you. I know days are tough out there. It's easy to look around and see the issues and the problems and the changes and the bureaucracy and the malpractice threats, and it goes on and on and on. But just remember this: your hope is in Jesus. Your peace is in Jesus. He's there with you. He's called you to this, and He's going to give you the grace, the courage, the strength that you need to serve Him well. Until we get together again, may God bless you.
Christian Doctors Digest is a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on Christian Doctors Digest are not necessarily endorsed by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations.